We have the tech to get food delivered in 15 minutes, but we all have horror stories about buying tickets. The Game Time app gives fans the advantage. Get amazing tickets in just a few taps. Fees are included, so what you see is what you pay. And the Game Time guarantee means authentic tickets at the best price every time. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets to concerts, sports, comedy, and more with Game Time. Download the Game Time app and create an account for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply.
Welcome to the D Word Podcast, where we talk dementia. Good to have you company for another D Word Podcast. The links between football and dementia is something we've continued to cover here, and with the world's best in North and Central America at the World Cup, seems like the right time to continue the story. And on this edition, we're going to be looking at how the design of the ball could be used to reduce the risks associated with the heading. Jan Phillips is an expert in sports technology from Loughborough University. Jan, it's great to welcome you to the D Word as my guest. Football and dementia story is something we've been following for many years on the show. And it was a friend of ours, Roy Heaney, who alerted me to the very good work that you've been doing there. You got a degree in sports technology at Loughborough. Before we go into your studies or whatever, what kind of drew you into that area to start with?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, Pete, to start with, and incredible podcast that you do, bringing together so many different people from different parts of this space. Sports technology is a really interesting field, actually, and slightly off to the side, I suppose, of what you might talk about normally. So it's really in around the design, manufacture and testing of sports equipment. But a large part of that is the interaction of that sports equipment, such as the ball, such as headgear, with the humans as well. And particularly my interest is in the safety aspect of a lot of that equipment. I've been a keen sportsman and involved in sport at many different levels for a number of years since I was young, done a lot of volunteering in sport and, you know, really, really care about people, I guess, but also a bit of a sports equipment nerd, I suppose, as well. So it's really a meshing together, I suppose, of two real passions of mine, which is sport and technology and sports equipment as well. And I had a particular interest in footballs when I was on my undergrad degree program, I suppose, in Loughborough, but wanted to do something involved in footballs that had a real meaning. A lot of research in footballs is around, you know, can you get the ball to fly 0.1% faster through the air, or, you know, have a slightly nicer touch to a player. But I suppose my original concept was, okay, so can we take everything that we know about the ball and re-engineer it in some way, I suppose, to make it safer, quote unquote, to head in some way, shape or form. And what I didn't know at the time was that was going to take me down quite a long research road into mechanisms of brain injury and out the other side now as to things that we can do about it.
Yeah, and it is, you know, a long road. Obviously, it's. I think it was in the 1920s that a doctor diagnosed, I think it was called dementia pugilistica, which was associated with boxing. And obviously, as the years have gone on, we've seen more and more footballers. I mean, in terms of the dementia angle, I must ask you, have you got a personal dementia story or not?
No, not personally, and I'm in many respects very, very, very grateful that I haven't, because obviously having spoken to so many people who have and heard their stories, it is, I mean, it's such a horrible thing, and I have such sympathy, not just for the experiences that people go through, but the courage and what the families have to go through as well with it is so heartbreaking in many respects. But there's so many amazing, and you I'm sure meet a lot of them on this podcast, really inspirational people around as well. And part of my role is to, you know, channel that energy into the cold, hard research, I suppose, to hopefully help do something about it and make positive change, I suppose.
Yeah, you know, let's go back in the story. I mean, football was organised into a league in 1888, so there's a fair amount of research to do there in terms of, you know, what the ball was like in 1888 and what it is now. But I guess, it, you know, it's something we all take for granted, but I guess when you start looking at the football and dementia story, large number of England's 1966 World Cup squad were living with dementia, and the first thing is everybody thought big, heavy leather footballs gaining weight when they get wet, so that must be the problem. But it is far from that simple, is it?
Yeah, no, it's a lot more complicated and nuanced than that, I suppose. So for those of your listeners who are not, I suppose, so into their football technology, footballs have changed quite significantly throughout the last 100 years or even longer than that. But they've changed within the laws of the game. So the laws of the game specify the size, shape, weight at the start of play, inflation pressure of the ball. So all of that's remained pretty much the same since the late 1800s when football was incepted. But the materials and the construction methods, as people will have seen through time, have changed. So there used to be these leather balls that were hand-stitched, and water used to get both into the leather itself but also between the panels. So they took up quite a lot of water and got heavier then throughout a match, throughout a training session. And that's what a lot of older footballers who have potentially gone on to develop dementia have flagged, I suppose, was that was they didn't enjoy heading those heavy wet leather balls. And there's always been that question of whether it was those balls specifically that contributed towards any dementia pathologies, assuming that it's due to heading full stop, or whether that risk might have continued going forward through into the synthetic ball era, where you've got synthetic balls that were hand-stitched, but also now in the modern day, synthetic balls that have lots and lots and lots of laminated layers and are often stitchless. So they're, for instance, bonded or welded sort of together in a one-piece construction. Now, I'm sure we might talk about this, but the research that we've been specifically looking at is this energy transfer into the brain via pressure waves. And those pressure waves happen right at the very, very start of the collision, within the first sort of 1% of the collision between the ball and the head. And that's really, really interesting because the amount of energy that goes into the brain is therefore dependent on the materials and the construction of that outer shell, as opposed to the whole mass of the ball more generally. So whilst we do see that leather balls increase their energy transfer from dry to wet conditions quite significantly, as we all might expect, perhaps what people mightn't have expected is that a lot of the modern synthetic balls have a greater energy transfer than the leather balls in both dry and wet conditions. So that's a really interesting finding and really important to bring to light. And I suppose we haven't found any, throughout all of our studies, we haven't found any evidence that changes to the ball have made this problem go away or anything like that. So that's really important to bring to light.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
This is the D Word podcast with my guest, Jochen Phillips. You know, that's number one, isn't it, of everybody thinking. And I guess the other one is, you know, you're far more versed in this than me, but I did do a little bit of research, and the speed that balls go at, you know, we were looking in the 1930s, maybe 60, 70 miles an hour. Now we could be looking at 100 miles an hour. And what kind of impact does that have on the whole story?
Well, yeah, be fair, Pete, if I had a pound for every time somebody asked me about the speed of the ball, I would be rich and wouldn't need to do any research. So it's a really important question to ask, both in terms of the mass and the speed, because obviously they intertwine a little bit. What we find quite interesting is that if you take common heading scenarios, so if you take a corner kick, for example, because that tends to be where a lot of headers come from. If you had a heavier, wet leather ball, you're still trying to kick it to the same location in the penalty box, right? So you're still trying to achieve the same outcome with it. So if you have a heavier ball that's taken up water, you would have had to have kicked it slightly harder in order to launch it with a quicker speed. Now, obviously, for those of you who are into aerodynamics, a bit more drag if the ball is heavier, et cetera, et cetera. When we have done some modeling of that, where we've taken leather balls, we've taken modern balls, we've put them through our wind tunnel, and we've simulated those flights, what we find is that the speed of the ball when it actually reaches the head is very, very similar between dry modern balls and a wet leather ball as well. So essentially what we think is going on is that the speed of the ball has been fairly similar for common heading scenarios throughout the history of the game. And what people, I think, forget about leather balls as well is they were very, very well crafted. You know, they had latex rubber bladders in them that were very, very lively, and they could be kicked very quickly, particularly when dry. Obviously, their properties changed slightly when they were wet as well, but we don't think that's quite as significant a factor. Obviously, the speed of the ball overall is significant, but the differences between old and new balls, we don't think is that significant. Or certainly as significant as what a lot of people try to make out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're expelling quite a few myths here. And, it's good to hear, because there are a lot of things that people think of. And I guess one of the other things is that, I've been a football fan all my life. Football has changed. And I think really there was a lot more reliance earlier on, speedy wingers, Stanley Matthews era, putting the ball across, big centre forward, heading it in. Whereas now it's a different game. And I guess, the whole nature of the game has to play a part in this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You're dead right. And it's one of the things that is, I think, the football research community as a whole is really struggling to get a grasp of is what people might call heading frequency. So, a player's exposure to heading over the duration of their career is related to both how many times they've headed the ball and, how often they head the ball and how much recovery time their brain has in between, for example. That's what we would call heading frequency. And then the magnitude of those headers as well, so how much energy is being transferred. The heading frequency bit is really, really difficult to measure because often training sessions have happened. Training sessions are happening now. It's very hard to determine where, how often people are heading the ball in training. There are guidelines now. How that compares to the levels historically, again, is really, really difficult. You're right to talk about styles of play as well, because obviously, those have changed, but they vary within an era as well. So, if you look in the Premier League, say 10 years ago, you had managers like Sam Allardyce, Tony Pulis, long ball football in the same leagues as Pep Guardiola. You see the Premier League now has gone very much back to set pieces, long balls. There seems to be a lot of heading going on there as well. Perhaps they're training for those scenarios as well, slightly more often. So, It's really hard to pinpoint that, but that's a really, really key part of the puzzle that I don't think people have quite gotten a grip of yet. Hopefully they will in times to come, but it's a really important part.
And I think, when you say people haven't got to the grip of it, you must also come into contact with players, managers, coaches. I mean, why is their take on all this? Because obviously they've got their tactics and various things, but, you must be introducing things they've never even thought of.
No, well, it's a really interesting one. I mean, there's guidelines from the FA now for to reduce the number of headers in training. I think it's limiting what they deem high force headers to 10 10 per session. I think that education piece across all of those different interested groups is really, really important, because I think, as you said, there's a lot of myths with the ball, with heading. It's a really difficult one to communicate because we don't have the full picture yet. There's loads of different jigsaw pieces put together, and people want answers. People want concrete answers. Science, unfortunately, is never quite as black and white as what people think or hope it might be. We're continuously in conversation with people who are trying to educate players, coaches better. Obviously, we put out research and engage with different people on it as well. It is really important, but that evolves, you know what I mean? And people's understanding will continue to evolve. It's for us to put that really good evidence in front of them to help them make decisions about their own clubs, their own players, and for the players, for themselves as well.
And, you know, there's an ability in doing all that research and also making it, presenting it the way that people understand. And also, you know, broadening out in football. I mean, I'm involved in non-league football. And so, you know, we're not just talking, you know, there are certain people who think that football was invented in 1993 with the Premier League, but, you know, we're not just talking about that. We're talking about guys playing in the park, etc. And, you know, there's a great difficulty getting that research across to that level as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, football is such a popular sport globally. You know, the elite level of the game represents such a tiny portion of the amount of people that play football. And it's, you know, like all sports, has such positive, you know, health implications, social implications. You know, it's so good for you. And, you know, no matter, you know, whatever the statistics are, you know, in terms of people sadly, you know, developing dementia in later life and the increased risk that footballers face with that, you know, it is still really, really important, you know, to give that message that people should continue to go out and play football, because it is so good for you, you know, your health more generally. I think one of the nice things about the research on the ball is there's an opportunity to make subtle changes to the ball that don't really affect the way the game is played or the way the ball performs more generally. And if those changes are made by manufacturers or made by the governing bodies, then that research naturally gets implemented at all levels of the game. And maybe is not even something that people particularly notice, that, you know, hopefully our education pieces and communication will make them aware that, you know, they're heading a different football that's informed by scientific research on heading. But it doesn't necessarily mean they have to understand what a pressure wave is to be able to do something about it. And it's, I think, one of the challenges we've got at the moment is, you know, really enacting that change to make sure that we're putting products in the hands of players at all levels of the game, kids, you know, males, females, you know, everyone involved in the game, you know, potentially without them even knowing. And it just becomes the norm that, you know, they've headed a different football.
It's interesting what you were saying earlier about the pressure of the ball, because we've all seen someone pick a ball up, give it to a referee, the referee squeeze it a little bit and go, well, yeah, that's all right, or it isn't. So, you know, there's no precise science in a lot of that, is there, while the game's going on?
Yeah, and I think it's nobody's fault that a lot of the laws of football were developed based on, you know, the available materials and constructions of the ball at the time, and, you know, ultimately what players like. For example, the inflation pressure law is a really interesting one, because it's 0.6 to 1.1 bar. It's quite a big range, really. And if anyone's pumped up a football to 1.1 bar, they'll know that it feels, you know, quite hard, really. And I think there's also an opportunity to reflect on, you know, given the new research around the ball and around heading and the implications involved, potential implications involved in that, I think there's a chance to, you know, reflect on some of those laws and some of those, you know, things that we just continue to do for years and take for granted, I suppose, about particularly the equipment in the game, and look at it and go, okay, why does that law exist in that way? And is there a different way that we could do this that makes more sense in the modern day with these concerns in place? And, you know, football has evolved as a game throughout history, and it will continue to. And this perhaps is just, you know, one part of it on the journey. When it's written into the scriptures in 100 years time, it'll be just another thing of how football has evolved to meet the needs of and concerns of the day. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, from pieces of tape for crossbars all the way through to kind of where we are now. I mean, in terms of the research you did looking back in years, were there any studies on any other sport or something else which kind of pointed towards this kind of brain wave attack sort of thing?
Not particularly in sport. It's something that hasn't really been seen, or not that it hasn't existed, but it just hasn't been measured in sport before, and nobody's particularly thought about measuring it in sport before. The military blast context is something that's really important and has inspired a lot of our thinking. So when we talk about a pressure wave is a vibration. It's partly a vibration. You know, a pulse of energy that is akin to something that you might see from an explosion in to military blast veterans. So a blast wave, a pressure wave, a shock wave, a stress wave, they're all, you know, it's a Hoover vacuum cleaner situation, right? They're all sort of the same thing. We know that pressure waves are a well-established cause of both short-term and repetitive long-term brain injury in military veterans. And that's a really, really important context that we've taken and then applied, I suppose, into sport and into football specifically. So it's been something different for football, for sure. And a lot of people in football are trying to translate head acceleration metrics, which you might measure from a mouth guard or something like that, that tend to come from more serious sporting impacts, and try and apply that to the more lower level non-concussive stuff. And we come at it from a slightly different angle and brought in a mechanism from a different context. Now, both of those represent what's going on to a player. So players are exposed to both, but we think that the pressure wave stuff has a particular relevance, I suppose, to potentially to the newer generation that we see in footballers specifically.
Is there, you know, is there a difference in terms of the sexes as well? Because obviously the women's game has only been played at elite level for a comparatively short period of time. So, you know, what about research into the women's game?
Yeah, super, super important question. And I guess part of the challenge with the women's game is that there isn't that longer term data. It's something that we struggle with in the men's game as well, because the picture is continuously evolving. So the people from the men's game who've sadly gone on to develop neurodegenerative diseases obviously played a long time ago. And in the same way that we're questioning, you know, what's the exposure like, what's the risk of modern day male professionals, it's exactly the same questions and the same challenges, I suppose, with the women's game as well. Women naturally have a slightly different, you know, anatomy and brain anatomy, skull anatomy to men. I think with pressure waves, they don't really discriminate. They are there, you know, no matter who you are. There is a suggestion that perhaps the geometry of the skull, the thickness of the skull, things like this might have an effect. We just haven't had the opportunity yet. We've been very busy with a number of different things and getting this research out there. One of the things I'd really, really like to do is to explore the differences between male and female skulls. And we can do that by, for example, because we recreate dummy heads in our lab. So we've got a male specific one at the moment, just because we had that MRI data available to us to be able to develop that surrogate. But I'd love to do it with with a female equivalent as well, and really understand what the differences are. And it's really, really important. And I think going forward, we should absolutely be doing stuff in, you know, parallel studies or integrated studies that have both in as well. The thing that's been conscious on my mind is that the ball is at the moment pretty much the same between the male and the female game. Mm. So you might see a different ball in the women's game, but it's generally the same ball as the men's game with different colours. Mm. And a different name potentially. But the actual construction and materials and panel designs are all the same at the moment. I hope that going forward, just on a separate point, that the women's ball evolves to be something that is more tailored towards the women's game. I think that would be a good step forward anyway. But I think the effect on the brain and on heading should play a key part into that.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
All our shows on UK Health Radio are available for listen again and download. All you have to do is go to the website ukhealthradio.com. On this edition of the podcast, I'm looking at how the design of footballs might cut the risk of heading the ball with sports technology expert Ian Phillips.
I guess one of the other myths as well that people come across is that everybody thinks it is the concussive hit that knocks somebody out, not those subconcussive ones. And we're kind of learning that from rugby. I know Alex Popham, who's the former Welsh rugby international, said that he must have had probably tens of thousands, if not more, subconcussive hits during training. And it's kind of, you know, that myth. Everybody thinks you've got to be Terry Butcher arriving with a massive great head bandage. It's not like that, is it?
No, and it's a really, really, really great question, because it's very easy to draw associations, I suppose would be the scientific word for it, between concussion and dementia, because naturally, if somebody has played contact sports over the years and gone on in later life to develop dementia, it is quite possible and quite frequent that they might have had a concussion or a number of concussions in their career. It doesn't mean to say that those concussions were the thing that has actually driven that dementia pathology. Now, obviously, I'm not a neuropathologist or anything, so I'm just sort of observing and speculating here, but what we do see is a number of CTE cases specifically reported, including in footballers in particular, where the players don't have any concussion history, but they do have that history of the repetitive, non-concussive heading of the ball that potentially wears away at the brain over a longer period of time. And that's a really important distinction, because it affects how we go about studying those collisions, because it's possible that concussion, which gives you instantaneous symptoms, damages different structures in the brain, potentially by different mechanisms of energy transfer, different mechanisms of how the head is hit or exposed, than those subconcussive, non-concussive ones as well. So it's a really, really important distinction at the sort of surface level that filters down into how we go about potentially solving these problems and investigating the mechanisms associated with them.
And, you know, I guess you've opened another door there, which I was going to come on to anyway. It's the area of the head which is subject to these pressure waves. And from a medical point of view, what's behind it and what damage can be done? And I guess that's kind of the next way forward. in terms of neuropathology. And, you know, it's kind of frontal cortex, CTE, frontotemporal dementia, possibly. And there does seem to be that kind of link. But obviously, you need the medics now to start looking at all this.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, you're dead right. One of the things that we see in footballers specifically, as you mentioned, is that frontal, it seems to be that the early pathology and starts to develop in that frontal region specifically, that people are naturally associating with the frontal location that people typically head at the ball with. Now, in other sports, that boxing, rugby, those pathologies have been seen in quite diffuse areas of the brain all over, and naturally as CTE progresses, it spreads anyway. But we have a particular interest in where that pathology starts, if that makes sense, because that's the bit that's related to the impact that we like to study. So that frontal region is a particularly interesting thing in terms of the pressure waves that we've measured, because it's that region just the other side of the skull from the impact location that experiences the greatest intensity of energy transfer from pressure waves. And pressure waves, like any vibration or wave that you might see on the beach or an earthquake wave or whatever, dissipates its energy with distance. So we see that frontal region, you know, having quite a high intensity of energy, and then the other side of the brain having less so. So that location is really important, and we really hope that people in the medical community, neuropathologists, neurotrauma researchers, will look to take this forward now and expose brain tissue to this form of energy and explore, you know, what damage happens, where does it happen, et cetera, to really link that biomechanics to the biology, I suppose.
Yeah, I think, you know, the more we're talking, the more I think that you're producing the fundamental building blocks here to take it forward. The only question people would ask would be, why didn't somebody do this? And I'm not expecting to be controversial or whatever, but, you know, Jeff Hastell was diagnosed in 2002, wasn't he, I think? And so, you know, it's been a long time, unfortunately, but at least now, you're on the track.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's been so much really, really good research in this space for so many years as well. And we're just adding to it, really. But it's required us to come with a slightly different skill set. I mean, people would typically think about brain injury in football being a medical problem. You know, I'm not a medical doctor. I'm not a neuropathologist. I'm a sports engineer, essentially. So, you know, it's really, really important. And I think the community of people involved in this is growing to include people with different skill sets. And I think once you start putting all those different people together, then new areas sort of come to light. And this is one of them that's really exciting, because there's something that we can potentially do about it quite quickly without changing anything about the game, really. To change the ball, protect the players, but also preserve the game without sort of waiting the potentially 10 or 20 years for that concrete medical proof. It's something proactive that can be done. And I think as time goes on, more of those opportunities will probably be revealed with people from different areas, different skill sets coming together and doing good stuff.
Yeah, I absolutely applaud that. And the more people talk about it, and, you know, as you say, involve people from other areas with other skill sets. It's been absolutely fascinating. I've learned my heck of a lot over the last 35, 40 minutes. We want to keep in touch without a doubt, because this story is going to go on and on, isn't it? It's unfolding before our eyes almost.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we'd love to. And we hope that it's just the start, really, because, you know, obviously the next step is to think about, you know, change and, you know, thresholds for damage from the neuropathological side, but also change to the ball. And change doesn't just happen, right? So we're working hard. We're talking to different people, different stakeholders about making that happen. And we hope that it's just the start, and we hope that it inspires more people to take an interest in this, perhaps put some money into it, but also, you know, look at what more can be done in the future, because it's such an important topic and affects the lives of so many people.
Absolutely. Well, for now, and it is for now, because we'll definitely get you back on the show. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Fantastic. Thanks, Pete. Pleasure.
Thanks to Ian for introducing a fascinating area of research, and I look forward to following the story as it progresses. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition. Thanks for your company, and I hope you'll join me again soon for some more Dementia Talk right here on the D Word Podcast.